Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. We most recently talked about Manchester by the Sea, so you can go to our website and check out all of our previous episodes at themacguffinman.com. Before that was Jackie, and then Traffic before that. I've written a handful of things over the last couple months, and I will be posting something about Gore Verbinski's A Cure for Wellness at some point in the near future, probably in the next couple days. But yeah, follow us on Twitter at themacguffinman, and that's about it.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
You didn't say welcome to the MacGuffin Men.
Did I not?
Nope.
Okay. Well.
You did say at the MacGuffin Men and something else with the MacGuffin Men in it.
Probably the website.
But I want them to be welcomed.
I mean, I'm feeling pretty aggressive this episode. Maybe I just don't. Maybe I don't care about what other people think today.
Yeah. Okay, that's fine.
Yeah, but welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. And we're here to talk about Moonlight, or as I prefer to call it, my dinner with Andre Holland.
Oh boy,
coming in hot.
Yep.
At least I cut my Deep Blue Sea joke off the podcast. So yeah, Moonlight, Barry Jenkins film.
Yep. Best picture.
Must be doing something right. So I don't know. Where do we start? Where do we start with Moonlight?
I don't know. I thought you said you want to take the lead on this one.
Okay. Well, I saw it back in October, mostly free of expectations, and I liked it. And I'm curious to know how you felt about seeing it in March, mostly totally wrapped up in expectations.
Yeah, I'll say that it was largely what I expected it to be. Mm-hmm. I knew a little bit about the plot, not everything. And, you know, it won Best Picture and had a lot of good things said about it even before that. And it was, yeah, largely what I thought it would be. I thought it would be good. It was good. I thought it would be, very kind of character-driven, a pretty quiet but well-done little piece. And that's what it was.
All right.
What about you with no expectations?
I wouldn't say no expectations, but... Because it was the talk of the Toronto Film Festival while I was working for the Toronto Film Festival, so I had some sort of expectations, but I thought it was quite good. And I will say the second time I saw it, I liked it a lot more because I started to realize there are a lot of small things in the direction of this movie that I found very impressive, and I think it's a really good movie, and I admittedly saw it the first time while I was sick, so that's kind of on me, but the second time I saw it, you know, I think a lot of things jumped out to me that didn't initially, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that helped the movie quite a bit, you know? Okay. I think it's a really, really good movie, you
know? Sure. Mm-hmm. What do these filmmaking or directing things that you stood out to so much?
Well, the thing that and this is going to seem like an insane comparison immediately, but The Silence of the Lambs is the movie that Moonlight reminds me of, and it's mostly because of how the film toys with perspective and how characters are being looked at, most notably Chiron, but this applies to everybody in the movie, just because there are a number of shots of the camera looking directly at a person and the person looking directly at the camera, right? That are meant to sort of, confront us with our own perspective, like how we are looking at these characters and how these characters are looking at each other. And I just felt the really slow progression of how the filmmakers used the camera to force our perspective in certain directions I found really interesting. And the Silence of the Lambs comparison being that the structure of the Clarice story in Silence of the Lambs is her sort of coming of age in her own right, in very different circumstances than Chiron. But the way that the movie accomplishes that visually is the most impressive thing about The Silence of the Lambs, and I think it's the most impressive thing about Moonlight here, you know?
Yeah, I think everyone, all of our main characters get that look directly into the camera, right? We obviously get it with Chevron, we get it with his mother,
Kevin
gets his in the last third, I would think.
Yeah, oh, for sure. He gets it a couple times. I know there's nothing for Juan or Teresa in that realm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Like we get Juan walking towards the camera, but it's not the like character standing still looking directly into the lens sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean we get pretty close to his face, but not the shot that you've described there.
Yeah, exactly. Not an aggressively let's look at it directly into his eyes sort of shot. Yeah.
Yeah, and do all those include kind of the image not lining up with the audio? You know, sometimes we have the character moving in slow motion, and we have the dialogue proceeding beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that included in all those?
Well, I think where you're thinking about that's Kevin and Chiron seeing each other in the restaurant, realizing or Kevin realizing that that is Chiron, and there's another moment earlier in the film where two characters are looking at each other. It's Chiron's mom and Chiron. It's the scene out in the yard in front of their home when they think when Paula says she's locked herself out of the house, and she's looking at Chiron and saying, you know, I'm your mom, right? Or whatever her line is. And Chiron's looking right back at her. So she's moving in normal motion. She's being shot at 24 frames per second, like the vast majority of this film. And she's the one talking. And then we cut to Chiron, and Chiron is being shot in slow motion. And it's even kind of hard to tell because he's not really doing anything. He's not saying anything. And there is a slip edit in what Teresa's saying. Like she speaks under an edit that happens, but she is still always moving in regular speed there, whereas Chiron is moving in slow motion. And what that's meant to show us is that those two characters just are on totally different wavelengths. Despite the fact that they're looking directly at each other, one character can't really tell what the other is looking at, just because, Paula's makeup is full of drugs at this point, you know, and she doesn't really see the world the way that Chiron does. And then jump to the use of that with Chiron and Kevin. They are both shot in slow motion, and Kevin speaks underneath those two shots of them looking directly at each other in slow motion. But the idea there is that, as opposed to Paula and Chiron earlier in the film, Kevin and Chiron immediately are like looking at each other the same way at the same speed. They're just moving at the same pace, you know?
Yeah, it's a very surreal moment for both of them, but they're both experiencing that surrealism at the same time. You know, it's a different moment than the moment surrounding it in the restaurant, because they don't recognize each other, or they've after that moment they've kind of recognized each other, and there's, you know, at least kind of you know, dealing with what's been kind of dormant between them for all this time. But there's that moment when they kind of first make eye contact, and it's, you know, time slows down. It's you know, it's just a very unique and powerful moment for them, for both of them. Mm-hmm. Unlike what he shares with Paula, which is still very you know, important and meaningful and a very emotional moment in the movie, but showing just how out of sync they are. You know, they share a house, but their outlook on each other and on the world is so different that they depict that feeling of being out of sync through frame rate.
Yeah, and notably, Chiron is coming from having spent the night at Teresa's house after Paula kicked him out. She said, it's the scene where Paula says, you can't be here tonight, I've got somebody coming over. And Chiron goes and stays with Teresa that night. And so it's notable that Paula is saying, you know, I'm your mother, right? And then we cut to Chiron, like, slowly. And the idea that I think we're supposed to have in her head is that Chiron is thinking, who is my mom at this point? You know, is it Teresa or is it Paula? Because, you know, one cares for me and one gave birth to me, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So one is the biological definition of mother, but the other one is the, you know, nurturing person who feeds you and puts you to bed, that is more the cultural definition of a mother.
Yeah, and teaches you how to make a bed. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, I just thought that was a nice added element to that moment.
Yeah, I like that line about grandma rules. you eat, you speak.
Oh, Grandma Rules is great.
Maybe that's more common in Liberty City and other places, but I thought that was a fun line that a concept I was unaware of.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And I mean, I am a strong believer in the idea that Andre Holland is this movie's secret weapon, and I think his performance has been vastly under-discussed due to the fact that Mahershala Ali is also a wonderful actor. But I just think this movie, so much of this movie relies on Chiron walking into this restaurant, seeing Kevin, and Kevin being immediately charming. And I mean, if they cast a person that wasn't charming as Kevin, or somebody that you don't want to spend time with as Kevin, I think this movie immediately starts to fall apart. And that Andre Holland is so likable and so engaging on screen, I think really helps the final third of this movie, like carries this final third of the movie. Carries the final third of this movie, you know.
Yeah,
and also I will say I'm a long time Andre Holland fan, so this might be my own bias sticking out, and I would just was surprised and very, very enthused to see Andre Holland was in this movie, which I did not know until he showed up. But yeah, I just think he's a really good effortless performer, you know.
Yeah, and so speaking of casting, how do you think they did for having the through line, these three characters being played by three different actors? I mean, Paula remains the same, but we kind of have a new cast every 40 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, and Teresa's in two parts as
well.
Right.
That's
yeah,
true.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a tricky thing to pull off, and it's not done perfectly. But I also can't. It just seems so difficult that it just couldn't. It wouldn't be possible, you know. Like,
unless you go Boyhood style.
Yeah, exactly. Which nobody but Richard Linklater has time for, because Richard Linklater time moves at a different speed for Mr. Linklater. But
totally, man.
Yeah, exactly. That's the speed it moves at. But yeah, I think every performer, you know, gets a different take on their character, but also sort of falls in line with what you'd expect. You know, the only people that are really setting the tone are the you know, first Kevin and first Chiron, and then everybody else sort of has to play within them. But I think everybody does a good job. I think teenage Kevin is great. Mm-hmm. I thought that guy was wonderful. The Chirons, all of the Chirons, I think have high points and low points in their performance, and but never to the point where I think this movie suffers because of it, you know.
Yeah,
and also there's so much good acting going on around them that you know, it still works, even though I would say all of the Chirons aren't up to the level of pretty much any of their scene partners.
Okay.
Yeah, and a lot of that is, in fairness, inexperience, you know. And yeah, this movie would also be hurt if anybody notable had been cast as Chiron in any of those roles, you know?
Yeah, especially because you would imagine that, you know, there just wouldn't be that many famous people at the age to play little, right? Like, they just wouldn't have a chance to have a career. So to go from one or two unknowns to someone that's, you know, someone's face that we know really well and has been established, I think would be pretty jarring.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So speaking of the movie in thirds, just beyond the casting, how did you like that approach?
I mean, I thought it was great. It's just, I don't know. It's an inventive storytelling technique, and obviously not unprecedented, but but good. I like it. I like that you can sort of tell such a long story temporally in the span of an hour and 50 minutes. And when you can do that, this movie flies as well. I think the pace of this movie is unbelievably fast. Like, the amount of time.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because it's, in ways it's so slow, and in ways they really avoid some of the things that, you'd expect in a movie like this. Mm. You know, I was just thinking about this. Sorry to cut you off, but I'm going to. just, you know, we see a few guns. We don't see a bullet get fired. I mean, we have a bit of, you know, I guess two action sequences, if you can call, you know.
A fight and a hand job an action sequence?
No, I mean, a fight and then a chair to the back a couple minutes later, yeah. Action. But there's not, I mean, there's sort of with Paula, but there's not a ton of really big, loud, actory moments of fighting. You know, there's no gunfire. There's no, like, you know, certainly no chase scene or anything like that. And Juan's death is mentioned in passing. You know, there's kind of a lot of big moments that just are glossed over. And I think that that was, I think that was really interesting in the way that you can actually have this movie plug along and maintain your interest with things like that. You know, there's huge moments, you know, prison is just kind of brushed off. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that speaks to the way that those have to have been such transformative, important moments to these characters, but those things kind of do become mundane at a point. You know, if that's your day in, day out for 10 years, it just, it really sinks in as part of your reality. It's not something that's, you know, flashy anymore. It's just, it's so, such an essential part of who you are that it doesn't get played for big emotions. And I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I really like the way this movie just sort of keeps most of Chiron's, I don't know, trauma might be a bit too strong, but off screen, in that they only show him getting beaten up once, but it's alluded to many times that it happens. And
yeah,
the movie is able to make you feel like he is constantly under terror without giving in to just showing these very horrifying sequences that would be easy to get the audience like feeling emotions. Like
plug that in every 10 minutes and you know, you have the feeling of torment.
Exactly. And I think avoiding that is what is able to, I don't know, like not lose me as an audience member, because I know when a movie is trying to manipulate me into feeling something. And I never really feel that with this movie. I think there are moments where Paula goes full spotlight or full Mark Ruffalo in spotlight, but like even those are brief, and I feel like those brief moments are earned. Yeah, exactly, by how the movie operates all throughout leading up to those scenes, you know.
Yeah, and I've seen in some reviews about this movie people saying that it's simultaneously very specific but also very sweeping. You know, it is very much a story about Chiron, but it's a story about a lot of people too, or a lot of communities. And I think that speaks to that, is not necessarily showing those specific moments, but just the kind of malaise that you deal with in between them.
Yeah, absolutely. Like so much of this movie is sitting at a table talking about what has happened, you know, as opposed to as opposed to actually seeing what happens. And I think that approach is wonderful. Speaking of that, why doesn't anybody ever eat with Chiron? A lot of people give him food, but nobody eats with him.
Well, Kevin's not hungry in the final meal sequence.
Okay.
I assume he just eats while he cooks and didn't know that he had a dinner date that night.
Yeah, so. Yeah, fair.
And I think it's just, I mean, at least at school, I just think he's the one who gets picked on. And by going to sit with him, you're just inviting trouble into your life. I mean, mm-hmm. I think it was interesting that Kevin was as good to him as he was, and he was pretty terrible to him. You know, the fact that he talked to him in public at all in high school, and that the middle third of this movie. Other than that, I mean, his mom's not going to eat with them because I don't know if she's eating much at all. Yep. With her drug use. And is there one in the first third that I'm forgetting?
Yeah, Juan buys Chiron food like at the very beginning, and then takes him back and wanted Teresa feed him again. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, I think Juan has a very strict diet. Like, the way that Black has a very strict no alcohol, only water drinking policy in the final third of this film.
For sure. And there is a scene when Teresa feeds in the second half, second third when Teresa feeds him again. I think the idea is that all of these people are providing Chiron with nourishment, and the idea that everybody else in the movie does except for his mother, I think is probably supposed to be something that we pick up on.
And that Chiron's you know, kind of starved for affection, starved for nourishment, not necessarily in a dietary sense.
Yeah. And also, sorry.
I did enjoy that they addressed him eating again so quickly in the first third when Juan brings him home for some chicken. This is a very small, even for a child his age, he appears to be very small and is just, you know, crushing another meal and quick, a bang bang, if you will.
But, oh, I will.
I think it's what you said. It's someone who is just very undernourished in every sense of the phrase.
Yeah, and also that sitting around.
And that certain, some people do care about him, but it's just not the people who you would think would.
Yeah, and sitting at a table and sharing a meal is such a like classically domestic thing that or event, you know.
Yeah,
that it just sort of, you know, Chiron needs people that he can sit at the table and have a meal with, whether or not they're actually eating or just giving him food and nourishment of other kinds. Yeah.
Trying to get him to talk.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and exactly. And I think the one moment where it seems like he might go to eat with somebody is at that the lunch scene with it's the day after Kevin and Chiron were together on the beach. And, you know, it looks like he might actually walk up to go sit with Kevin, and then Terrell sits where Chiron would have sat, you know, and he's just
blocks him out of that position exactly where he would kind of find that nourishment, and not even just nourishment, but friendship and company and companionship.
Yeah, exactly.
So then he eats at the staff table.
Sadly, there was no monologue telling us about all the different parts of the cafeteria and where you can sit and where you can't sit.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I did think of that moment. That's so bad.
On Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, we wear blue.
Exactly. I'm getting cheese fries. What about the different looks to all three parts of the movie? Because this is something you'd have a better eye for than I would because of the visual aspects of it.
Yeah, well, what they tried to do, cinematographer James Laxton and director Barry Jenkins, was they tried to, this movie shot digitally, but they tried to emulate different film stocks for each segment of the film. And so the first segment, I believe, is Fuji. The third would be a Kodak stock, and the middle is some like old, long out of print film stock, like Russian film stock or something, that makes everything more green and cyan, I think. I will say I didn't notice a ton of change in the colors. Like, the greens really pop in the first third, that's for sure. It's just like the blues pop all through the movie, and especially in the second part. But I do think this isn't like Traffic, where every
not even close.
No, exactly, where it's just so so aggressively changing, you know, to the point where I don't think anybody would notice if you didn't tell them, including me, you know. The thing that I found interesting about cinematography choices in this movie is the use of the lenses that they used, because this movie's shot anamorphic, which is to say they use the whole sensor and sort of compress it into this widescreen cinemascope, but with that you sort of get a little bit of distortion on the edges. And specifically with the lenses that they shot this movie on, I believe they're the Hawk V lights. They're used in a variety of movies. You know, The Handmaiden is another recent movie that used it, but it is sort of a set of lenses that is within reach for a movie of this budget. The budget was $1.5 million, I believe. And what it does on these wide shots is there's even more distortion than in a lot of anamorphic lenses. So in the corners, the corners and the, you know, outside of the middle circle or middle oval, I guess, of these frames, we see a lot of distortion and a lot of things that are out of focus. And speaking or going with the things I've said about perspective earlier, it just sort of is interesting that this movie is so much about the type of people or a type of person that film has generally ignored. And what this movie is doing is trying to push somebody from the edges where they're out of focus into the center, and to show us this different kind of life that is generally underseen in cinema. And I thought that was an interesting lens choice. And also the fact that there are a lot fewer wide angle shots in the third part. So there's a lot less distortion in the third part, whereas the first two are, you know, we're kind of looking at them as memories at this point. You know, it's they are of the past, some of them, or the second part, the more recent past, but there is still like these memories are fraying on the edges, and there's a lot more wide angle stuff in the first part than there is with the second part, and there's still some in the second part, but in the third there's very little. And I thought that that really carried through, like especially like the first shot of the movie. It's the one where Juan's getting out of his car. There's just so much distortion on that lens, and you can really see it when he's standing with his employee. And and it's really jarring to start the movie. That shot in general is jarring in a number of ways, but
the spinning camera and
but you know, that sort of that fraying at the edges, I think, is meant to show a couple things, most notably that we are pushing people from the edges into the center frame.
Yeah. So speaking of the first third, and you kind of mentioned this when you were talking about the colors, you know, a lot of the greens really stand out. I didn't think that the neighborhood, Liberty City, which is, you know, famously a rough community, and, you know, is depicted as such, you know, having drug and violent problems, it just doesn't show up as very gloomy, you know. Like, I think it's run down, certainly, and dilapidated. I mean, the house that he runs into is boarded up and abandoned when he's running from the bullies. And, you know, as you said in that first scene, it's not we start this movie with a drug deal, and, you know, an older man very desperate for more drugs and, you know, not having a lot of money. I just wanted to know what you thought of that. I mean, like, it's not that the neighborhood's still very bright and colorful, even though we see it as this kind of negative, imposing area.
Yeah, I think part of that is
budget.
A little part of it, yeah, absolutely. And I think the other part of it is that going, you know, back to how they don't show Chiron being beaten up every 10 minutes. It's just that we don't want to force you to feel something. We want you to feel something more maybe something more organically, and feel something more powerfully at the ending of the movie, since we are able to ignore these things throughout the hour and 45 minutes leading up to it, you know.
Yeah, and if everything was just shadows and needles and broken glass for the whole time.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why it's really front heavy with that stuff, is that they only wanted to show so much, so they wanted to set up this world. You know, the first thing we see is Juan going to visit one of his drug dealing employees, a non-drug deal in progress, and then we see Chiron running, and he runs into a place where he picks up a crack pipe, and you know, it sets a lot up very quickly. And we also get Paula buying drugs in that first third as well. And you know, there's just this constant sense of like, this isn't a great place, but we don't need to show you why, you know. Like, you've seen scenes in movies that show that, you know. And even just showing a confrontation at a drug deal is almost like too much for Moonlight to do. It's one of her one of Naomi Harris's spotlight moments. And and I think they consciously didn't want to do it, and also they didn't have a ton of money for these big wide setups that you could have done these things. So that's my idea. And also, I think just to show that in reading interviews with Barry Jenkins and Terrell, God damn it, I forget his name, the co-screenwriter, McCarvey is his last name, and
Alvin McCraney.
Okay.
Terrell Alvin McCraney.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. And I think they sort of saw Liberty City as this place that was at one point like a really good place to live, and then crack came in. So I think they also
they grew up there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They wanted to see, to sort of show the place as this beautiful, bright place where a child could theoretically have fun, but also these things exist within it, you know.
Yeah, no, I really like it. I mean, it's for a lot of the reasons you just said, to not just show it as this, to kind of not take the shortcut and just have it shadowy or rainy, or, you know, a lot of these kind of signifiers, to make it look somewhat like the world that we inhabit in our everyday life, but there's just these elements that exist there that make it a lot harder for some people. And to drop us into that world, I mean, it still is Liberty City. I mean, it's still what it looks like. It's still, you know, buildings not kept very well. Mm-hmm. But to kind of not take those shortcuts, I think, is good. And especially at the start of the movie, that would be a really quick way to kind of build that world, to have this negative impression right away, but they don't do that. And, you know, that scene at the beginning, and a lot of the scenes that take place in that world in the first third, I get more dread in the diner sequence at the end before he starts talking to Kevin. You know, he kind of, it's dark, he looks outside, you can tell he's very nervous about how this is going to go. Like, there's I get the sense that there's more unpleasantness there for him than there was at the beginning. And I know that's not true, but I just mean from, you know, a character perspective, the fact that the story focuses so much on the personal, that I think it speaks a lot to the fact that that kind of evokes more of a sense of dread than, you know, the hood could at the beginning of a movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're 100% right in that, because all throughout the movie, we see Sharon starting to, or figuring out a way to live inside of these things that keep happening to him. You know, he most explicitly talks about it when he's talking to Kevin. He says when he went to Atlanta, he rebuilt himself from the ground up. And you're right in that the thing the movie wants us to think is that the most difficult thing for him is being himself to Kevin, just because he has been punished so many times for being himself, both physically and emotionally, and that's the real difficult thing for him to do, is to actually be a human being with another human being. You know?
Yeah, and I think we get it very quickly in the shot after they share that moment on the beach, and after he's kind of gripped the sand and he kind of realizes he's left a mark, and he just wipes it out. You know, mm-hmm. It's no one would walk down the beach and see a handprint and be able to make an inference, about Sharon's sexuality, but he just, it's kind of this mark of who he is and an experience that he's had, and he just feels the need to wipe it away. You know, even though the beach would wash it away eventually, or someone stepping on it, or if nothing ever happened to it, no one would be able to use it as evidence against him. It's something that he has such a hard time being himself, that to leave an imprint of it has to be, you know, has to be treated as a mistake that needs to be undone.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he says, "I'm sorry," at the end of that scene too. And Kevin says, "What are you sorry for?" You know?
Yeah.
So yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. That's just a visual depiction of it that I enjoyed.
Yeah, absolutely. Can I talk about Mahershala Ali for a second?
You could talk about him for more than 1 second.
Okay. He's the best, right? Like, he's really good in this movie.
Yeah, again, this is a, now I know I'm watching a best supporting actor winner. So, and I have so little experience with him, mm-hmm. Just not having watched House of Cards or many of the things that he's been in, and now I get the feeling I'm going to be seeing him in a lot of things, but I just didn't have a ton of exposure to him, and I mean, I'm not saying he didn't do a good job in this, but it just came more loaded to me than it may have for someone seeing it beforehand.
Yeah, and I, along with the Yandere Holland thing, I was a Mahershala Ali fan before I saw this movie, and even more so now. But because, you know, like, he's in Benjamin Button, which is a movie I was big on when it came out in 2008. So, yeah, he's just always been in my head, you know, since then, because he's really good in that movie, in a very small role. And the same set of him in House of Cards, I basically checked out of that show when he walked off, you know. So, like, and just the there's a quality about him that is just so interesting and so watchable. He does, you know, we've talked about this a lot, how people don't really have movie star charisma anymore, and I'm not saying he has the type of charisma that makes me want to watch a Tom Cruise movie or a Denzel Washington movie, but he's at least halfway there, you know. And yeah, the key to his performance in this movie, and the thing that, but one of the things that makes him memorable, he's unfathomably watchable in his scenes where he's actually in the movie, but the important thing is that when he gets taken out of the movie, and he's in the movie for the first 36 minutes and then he's not in it again, you need to miss him, you know. And that's what he needed to accomplish in a very small amount of time, is to make himself, you know, aside from giving all of his lines in a very engaging way, he needed the movie needed to miss him afterwards, because that's what Chiron has to do. He misses Juan because Juan was taken away from him. And I think that's got to be such a daunting task. And it's just like what I was saying with Audrey Holland in the final third, is that we have to want Chiron to stay in this room with him, just like we have to want Chiron to want to go back to being with Juan, even though it can never happen again. And I just think that's such a difficult thing to ask of an actor, and that Mahershala Ali was able to pull it off so seemingly easily is I think really important to the movie, you know, and really impressive.
Yeah, and it's, you know, a lot of this movie is things that we've seen before. I mean, we have this idea of the successful drug dealer filling in as a father figure to someone growing up in that in, you know, the area that drug dealer would work. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's something that's done here, but then we have the scene of, you know, it's dynamic because we have him being good to Chiron, you know, feeding him, taking care of him, and teaching him to swim, and just being a generally good kind of leader for him. And then we have the sequence where, you know, we see the line connect all the dots between him being a drug dealer, him dealing, you know, very close to directly to his mother, which is a cause of so many of Chiron's problems. You know, yeah. We kind of get them all mixed up in that one scene, and you know, that's tough.
Yeah, like, exactly. Okay, so we talked about the opening shot of this movie briefly, but we didn't really get into it, you know. We didn't roll up our sleeves and dive in, but I really like the beginning of this movie. Unsurprisingly, because it starts with a Steadicam Oneer, which I am in.
Odd Mahershala.
Yeah, well, yeah, also that. Not all of it, though. Not all of it, but enough of it. But just, and also, even before we see an image, the music that's playing, I forget the artist's name, but we'll just call it the song Star. I enjoyed it right off the bat, partially because Kendrick Lamar's last album, To Pimp a Butterfly, starts with the exact same sample, and and which is in no way concurrent thought. I don't buy that To Pimp a Butterfly comes out in March 2015 and then this movie comes out a year and a half later without Barry Jenkins knowing this. But I still like it. I like that they did it. I like that they kept it in, and decided to use it because of Kendrick Lamar, because it does kind of set up the idea that all of these people that have been ignored are still people of their own, you know. And I enjoyed that, sort of setting the table, and then Juan getting out of his car and walking to meet his employee, and then this swirling sort of Steadicam shot that. Honestly, the first time I saw it was very disorienting. I mentioned I was sick. I was also sitting in like the second row of a movie theater, and it was just
at the one IMAX screening of Moonlight.
The way I sit, every movie is IMAX. But it was just like I was like I could legitimately feel a little like queasy because of this shot, and. I having seen it again, that's now what I know the movie wanted me to do, because so much of this movie doesn't involve you know, seeing a lot of area in one shot, or a big area in one shot. Most of it involves just looking straight ahead, whereas there are these few wonders where we actually get to see more of the environment around us. And what that shot is doing is setting up this environment where we're in. You know, we've got Juan walking and watching a non-drug deal happen, you know, watching this guy get thrown away more or less without drugs, and then I don't know the character's name who works for Juan, but him signaling to somebody else to get him out of here, and you know, also Juan just talking to this guy like this is a normal occurrence, because it almost certainly is a normal occurrence. And then we've got Chiron running by, and just the idea that this movie that ends up showing us so little at one time, you know, the movie as a whole ends up, I think, accomplishing a lot, but in any given shot, there's really not a lot happening, that it starts with such a big shot that gets so much across and feels so disorienting, and also shows, you know, gives us this idea of a whole world, and also a whole world that you have to be cognizant of, because, you know, a character like Juan always has to watch his surroundings, and he can't sit with his back to the door, as he tells Chiron later, you know, because you never know when somebody might creep up on you. And that's sort of how the world feels to Juan, just that you just have to be watching everything at all times. And that's how the world starts to feel to Chiron as well, as he's being tormented by these bullies. And I thought that was a really cool way to start the movie.
Yeah, and, you know, as you said, someone in his line of work has to, you know, theoretically be watching for police and rival drug dealers, you know, a variety of people. But it's also the sense that he has this sprawling world, and, you know, he has a girlfriend, it seems, but it looks like he's happy to be able to focus his attention on someone. You know, he could very easily just ignore Chiron, or, you know, drop him off at home and never see him again, and no one would really, you know, think that he abandoned somebody. You know, this is all just a personal attachment that he has. So he kind of has this, you know, this business, this world that he has to watch over so much, but then find someone he feels he can direct, you know, some of this attention, some of this affection towards. And that's what we find as the scope of the movie gets smaller and smaller and focuses more on Chiron.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not, you know, even I think you're 100% right. But even within that, it's not like this is the last time we see a long take in this movie. You know, we get a couple, couple later, like in the second part, or the second third, we get a scene of Kevin and Chiron talking. It's when Chiron is watching out for Terrell because he's worried that Terrell's going to beat him up. And, you know, Kevin gets out of detention and they have this conversation. Most of that is done without a cut. There's a cut towards the end of it as their conversation's wrapping up. But it is the way that those characters move is really disorienting. And it's just sort of these two people sort of bouncing around, and you sort of feel like Chiron, despite the fact that they get along, he doesn't quite know where he sits with Kevin. And I thought that was really, really cool. And then there's also the shot of right before the beatdown happens, when Chiron walks out in the yard, and then we see Terrell, and Terrell's circling like a shark. Like, I made a joke to you about this, but like his even his hat looks like, his toque looks like a fin, you know. He's this shark circling in the water waiting to pounce, you know.
Yeah.
And
shark pounce,
yeah. And and that he's also surrounded by so much blue, because that's the bluest school in the history of blue schools. But you know, and that whole scene, and then even within that, as he's circling, like, he's still tormenting other people around him. He knocks somebody's book out of their hand. Like, it's amazing. Like, he's a real terror that, like, 10 seconds, you know. But it's this really engaging shot, and he's the only person we can really focus on because of the way the camera's moving, and it's a bit of a longer lens, so it's hard to see anything else. And then when the shot ends, we end with Kevin, right? And it ends in this close-up of Kevin's face, and it's the first time we've seen him in the shot, and the whole thing is really disorienting because you have no idea where people are in this space. You know that the camera's been circling and that they probably, like, push Kevin in at some point, you know, to have him end up at as the center of the last part of the shot, but still, that shot is so disorienting. And then I think it's meant to sort of convey what Chiron and Kevin end up feeling in that scene, you know. And I thought that's really impressive, you know.
Yeah, it's with Wonders, it's impressive because, you know, it's not a Goodfellas or a Creed or True Detective raid or Boogie Nights intro. You know, there's not that many moving parts, and it's not over that large of a geographical area, but you still have to appreciate that is a lot of moving parts and complicated marking, and just you have to hit it all. Every person on screen there has, and people behind the scenes have to hit all their marks perfectly. So even when it's not something as grand and cinematic as some of those movies and TV shows I described, it still has to be appreciated what a difficult thing that is to pull off and make it look good and also have meaning within the story.
Yeah, absolutely. And the idea that, you know, the first one with Juan, it's a mostly really well-composed shot, you know. The camera moves smoothly. Like, it's a wide lens on a steady cam, so it looks like, you know, it's just sort of, it feels like it's just sort of floating in air, you know. Even though those movements and the circling can be disorienting, the actual camera movement is not. And, or sorry, the actual picture, you know, if you're looking at this picture. Whereas that scene, specifically the one with Chiron, Kevin, and Terrell, that's probably still on a Steadicam, but it's just so much harder to operate on a longer lens in a in that type of long shot that it just sort of naturally will have more bounce to it and be more disorienting, and you can just see less, you know. And that they're both using long takes in a similar sort of manner to get across totally different things is really cool. And I think you know, the capper on this stylistic choice that they make in the movie happens when we get Chiron walking into the restaurant for the first time at the end of, towards the end of the movie, where, you know, he walks into the restaurant, Kevin tells him, you know, he'll be with him in a minute, doesn't realize who he's talking to, but we just see Chiron sort of walk from this restaurant to the far corner of the bar, and he sits down, and then the camera pans over and we see Kevin at work a little bit, and then Kevin walks down the bar, and the cut happens right as Kevin realizes who he's talking to. And then we get those two slow motion shots that we talked about, where Kevin sees Chiron sees Kevin, and they're looking at each other, both shot in slow motion. And it's just, I don't know, I think it's very cool the way that the movie combines those two stylistic choices and brings them together so smoothly. It's like, this is a world, we're showing you the world here, we're showing you where these two characters are now, where they've walked into and where they are existing, but in the span of like one cut, nothing else matters, you know. It's just, yeah, these two people are the only thing that matter in this movie right now, and also each person is the only thing that matters to the other, you know. And I think that's really cool, and there's so many little things throughout this movie that really play with the perspective of how you see the world, how the world appears to you and to the characters, and also how other people appear to you as the viewer and also to the characters. And I just think all of these little things add up to something pretty great. Yeah.
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 Do you have anything else before we talk about it's Best Picture win?
I think there are a lot of little, really good little moments in this movie. I mean, I'm just gonna list a few of them because they're all like good little things that I just feel like really stick out in a movie like this positively.
And Kevin making him dinner.
Well, I mean, that's great. And I listened to an interview with James Laxton was at TIFF recently, and TIFF made a video of him talking about some of his favorite shots in Moonlight. He talks about shooting that Andre Holland making the dinner, the chef special at the end, and he said as he was shooting it, he was his own camera op. He's saying like Andre Holland was so like unaware that there was anybody else around him. You could see how locked in he was that Laxton actually like peeked out from behind the eyepiece. He's like, I want to see this in real life as opposed to through the camera. And I thought that was really cool for a number of reasons. Like, it's cool that, you know, Laxton can be both professional and still get sucked into this type of performance. And it's also cool because Andre Holland is super cool, you know? And that scene is good. When he first gives Chiron his food, and Chiron drops a bean on the table and then still eats it. I think that's a really great moment of improv. And the my SpaghettiOs go hard line is obviously great. But
yeah, that's wonderful.
It's so good. And like, that's probably, you know, right before that is probably when they get back into the scripted material. But that both of those actors were able to carry on. In, you know, a moment that's helped by not having to cut, I think is great. You know, there are two really great pieces of acting in this movie that I want to talk about because they're from characters that we haven't talked a lot about. One of my favorite moments in this movie is when it's the last scene with Chiron, Juan, and Teresa sitting at the table, and Chiron's asking what's the F word, you know, what does that mean? And Juan is talking to him and he's, you know, he's trying to explain it to him like a father would answer this question. And he gets to a point where he's just like, he doesn't really know if he should keep talking or anything. He says, I mean, unless, and he's like looking up to Teresa. Teresa's just shaking her head. Like, this is where we cut it. This is not our area or perhaps your area of expertise. Like, we just shouldn't, you know, sometimes more is less. And the way she plays that, I think, is so great. And it's such a simple moment, but I think it works so well. And the other moment that I really love is when in the second third after Chiron's been beaten up. He's in the principal's office. Like, that whole scene is really good, but him being offered help from the principal or whoever is in that office, telling him, like, you know, what we can do, all this stuff, and her voice starts to drop out, and we can see him, like, physically start to become the Chiron that he talks about going to Atlanta and rebuilding himself from the ground up. I just, like, somehow that actor is able to convey that, all of that, like, so quickly, of just him turning, and it's just, like, he just can't trust the world anymore. Even this woman that seems like she probably has her heart in the right place, like, she's muted to him, you know? And I thought that
they're entirely to help him.
Yeah, exactly. And the sound is really helpful there, but just in the visual aspect of his performance, it's amazing. And, you know, I think he's the performer in this movie that has gives the less or least good performance, but that might be my favorite piece of acting in the whole movie. So it's like, it's very odd. It's very odd contrast, but I thought it was great. And you know, those little moments just need to be mentioned, I think, because a movie like this is all about the little moments. And so it's impressive. We haven't really talked about the ending, which I feel like we should discuss, because I mean, it's all building to the ending, like most stories do. You know, as Chiron and Kevin, as they leave the restaurant, just before they leave, when Kevin puts the song on the jukebox that reminded him of Chiron and led to him calling Chiron, you know, it's a song that seems to be singing, like, Hello Stranger, and a variety of other lyrics that seem to be about seeing somebody for the first time in a long time. It feels like a really rom-com-y situation, you know, like, I'm going to put on this music and then we're going to dance or whatever. And it seems like the scene might start to be going that way, and then we get that cut to the close-up of the bells, you know, and then we're outside the restaurant and Chiron and Kevin are leaving. That's a great moment, because had it turned into some rom-com shit, it would have been real bad. But and then going back to Kevin's house, I love when Kevin's making the tea, puts the pot on the stove, and you know, we see this blue flame and also the pot slowly rocking back and forth, like, just this another small moment of detail. But and then Kevin and Chiron, like, they have been you know, they've been talking all night, and we just sort of finally get to a point where Chiron is willing to be, like, totally honest with somebody, you know. He's willing to say to Kevin, like, you're the only man that's ever touched me, and Kevin immediately understands the weight of what's being said. And, you know, we've talked a lot about the way this movie uses perspective, and those shots where we're looking head on at one character. The second last shot of this movie is we get a dissolve to the two of them sitting together, and we're looking at them head on. They're not looking at us because they don't care about us anymore, right? They don't care how they're seen by us. And it's the first time we see Chiron in one of those shots with somebody else. You know, he's now willing to be himself totally. And that's, you know, that's the culmination of all of these shots throughout the movie of people being alone. Chiron is now with somebody that he's now able to feel like a human around somebody, because he's willing to be honest with somebody. And I think that's this really beautiful moment for the movie to end on, and a moment that is really built up to throughout the movie. For obvious reasons, it's so much better that they're not looking at the camera, because that would have been, like, too intense, you know, and also would have broken their own moment. And then we get the final shot of the movie where it's young Chiron standing in the moonlight at the beach. And, you know, there's throughout the movie, there are so many discussions of water and Chiron loving water and, like, wanting to be, or sorry, like, sort of being in water or around water. You know, him going to the beach, him in the bathtub, in the sink, with dunking his head in the sink. And the idea is that he can only really be himself out on the water, right? Which is what happens in the middle of the movie when Kevin and Chiron are on the beach. And there are these other moments with him as a child where he's in the bathtub, which is like water, but it's contained water, you know, same with the sink. And same with all the water that he drinks in a glass, you know, it's like, it's water, but he's not able to flow freely. You know, this water isn't able to flow freely. And just before he goes into Kevin's house, he stops and pauses, and they're near the beach. He sees the beach, and we get a POV shot from him. He can feel the breeze that him and Kevin had talked about many years ago. And the water is so close to him, but he knows he's not there yet. He still has to fully open up to somebody and share his emotions with somebody. And then he can get to the water. And then we get that last shot after the two shot of Kevin and Chiron. And the idea, I think, is that he is finally looking back at us like, I'm past this. I'm going into the water. I'm finally able to go into this water by myself. And you can join me if you want, like if you're comfortable enough to. But I'm going, you know? And and I love that, you know? I thought that was like a really good, quiet way to end the movie.
Yeah.
As opposed to some like celebratory sex scene, which would have been an absolute nightmare of an ending.
Yeah. Yeah, I was wondering if you look at the last third as entirely positive. I mean, I guess right at the very end, I think we're left with the idea that he is able to speak honestly and, you know, be open about who he is. But are we supposed to kind of take who he's become negatively? You know, is the what we see in the first two thirds and what we don't see in prison, you know, causing him to build himself up in an artificially walled off kind of way, you know, and becoming who he is more of a defense than a true illustration of who he is.
Yeah. Well, I think what we see at the end of the movie is him admitting to himself that who he is isn't what he wants to be, but this is also the first time he's been able to admit to somebody who he really feels like he is, the movie's not, you know, it's not all suddenly sunshine and rainbows. Chiron still has a lot of work to do to have a comfortable life, but just the idea that
it's
a huge step for him, and even getting this far is huge, you know. And giving his mom a hug in his last scene with his mom, like that's a big thing too. You know, it just sort of feels like you're 100% right. The world is not suddenly all perfect, but at least it's not all shitty anymore. You know?
Yeah, and it seems to be heading in the right direction.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah,
yeah. So yeah, I do want to talk about this movie winning Best Picture. Partially for self-congratulatory reasons, because
did you make this movie?
I did make this movie. I am Barry Jenkins, all hail. Just the idea that on our La La Land podcast, I did predict that Moonlight would win Best Picture, so everybody hail. I don't know. I just thought it was, like, I'm not going to get into the La La Land thing in too much detail, but just the idea of this movie winning over La La Land is cool to me, because even though I like La La Land, it has made so much money that its impact has already been felt in Hollywood. I think like the movies that will get made because of La La Land's success didn't hinge on it winning Best Picture, right?
For any amount of time.
Yeah, exactly. Emma Stone says too soon. Whereas Moonlight, while successful for a movie of its budget, this type of movie winning Best Picture allows other cool movies to be made, right? Whereas I think we're gonna get three cool movies, you know, this is obviously just a guess number, we'll get three cool movies made because of La La Land's success, and we'll get three cool movies because of Moonlight's Best Picture win, right? Whereas I don't think we wouldn't have gotten the three that Moonlight would create without it winning Best Picture. And I just think despite the fact that they are La La Land and Moonlight are closer in the cinematic world than anybody sort of would imagine they are, just because La La Land is a much more independent movie than people think. It just sort of got built up as like the big Hollywood movie because it's about big Hollywood and turns its $20 million budget into something that looks like 80. Whereas Moonlight is just very obviously an independent movie that does an amazing amount of work with very little money. But it's still, you know, it just seems more independent. And I think getting these smaller movies made is cool. And Moonlight winning is cool because it will get more movies made. And I also sort of feel like it's this culmination of something that's been happening within the Academy Awards, and that other than The Hurt Locker, I think this is the lowest grossing movie to ever win Best Picture. But it's not like we haven't seen small movies winning Best Picture over the last little bit. You know, like there's been Spotlight, The Artist, The King's Speech wasn't a huge movie. But even when you go back and look at Best Picture nominees throughout the years, they have just steadily been getting, it's been smaller and smaller movies. There are no like giant grand Hollywood, like The Aviator is a good example of this type of movie where it's a $100 million budget, made seemingly specifically to try and get awards for various people. And now all the budgets of these movies are just getting smaller and smaller because, as many people have famously said, the mid-budget movie, the $50 million movie, just doesn't exist anymore. And I just think we're sort of getting to a point where the Academy Award-winning movies are just going to keep getting smaller and smaller. And I think historically, Moonlight's going to end up sort of signifying a real change in history, like hand in hand with Spotlight, which is another smaller movie that won for Best Picture last year. You know, I think this is just going to be the way that it continues to happen. Like, if 3 years from now, it's not going to be a surprise that the small movie won Best Picture.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to get smaller than this.
Yeah, well, I'm not, but like, yeah, exactly.
No, I know what you mean. It'll be on this end of the spectrum rather than Titanic's winning.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's not like when you look through the history of Best Picture winners, it's not like no little movie has ever won, you know. But say even you go back to Crash in 2006, that was the little movie that somehow won Best Picture, you know. But that was like a huge outlier at the time. And it's just very, very uncommon historically for a very small movie to be made, you know.
Yeah.
Or sorry, to win Best Picture.
To win.
Yeah. So I just think like... it's better that Moonlight won, despite the fact that I like both Moonlight and La La Land a lot for different reasons, I suppose.
Do you think that, I know this is something everyone's talking about, but not necessarily in this context. Do you think that La La Land's brief win of Best Picture will kind of be part of a narrative of what Moonlight might come to mean? Like it was, even if you're gonna talk about the little movie that could, like this is the movie that was so good that it like it fought back in this very odd way.
I think the and it's weird because like in the moment when they announced that Moonlight actually won, I was like, it's insane how well this is playing into the narrative of these two movies as we've been told throughout the awards process. Like the big movie wins, but then the little guy actually wins, you know. Like I just couldn't believe,
like, La La Land felt like the inevitable winner and everyone was kind of not even waiting for the announcement, and to the point that it was such a given that they even said it.
Even Faye Dunaway was like, well, this looks right, La La Land, you know. And just like in the moment that it played into this narrative so perfectly, it's bizarre to me. I mean, I mentioned this to you. I quickly became obsessed with looking at photos of the audience as people started to figure out what had happened. I think my favorite is Trevante Rhodes, like literally clutching his heart as he's like heading to the stage. It's such an amazing photo, and it's like such like pure shock and joy simultaneously. But and it just sort of plays into exactly what I'm talking about. It's just like people don't expect the little movie to win, but also I think there has sort of been a change in the way that movie making is, or movies are made, in that they're just isn't really big Hollywood anymore when it comes to the awards. Big Hollywood went to Marvel and DC, you know.
Which isn't awards bait, right?
Yeah, exactly. Captain America Civil War never really had a Best Picture shot. And all those idiots talking about how Deadpool should have been nominated for Best Picture can get hit in the back with a chair by me.
I just think that a great example of that little narrative is the, you know, just you talk about Trevante Rhodes being so clearly emotionally engaged in that, and that this was the, you know, the little movie about an honest depiction of genuine emotion and expressing who you are and how you really feel, and that like there's this tiny little microcosm even within the ceremony of it being such a personal movie and having these such a personal expression of those emotions right within the ceremony.
Yeah, exactly. Agree entirely. So.
Sweet.
Yeah. Thank you for listening. Thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Man. We didn't welcome you, but we'll send you off. But yeah, be sure to check back next week. We'll be talking about something else.